So Sri Aurobindo is examining the personal truth of being within the larger context of social being in the still larger frame of the evolutionary urge as it manifests on Earth, both of which are aspects of the transcendence expression in time and space, its self-discovery of its hidden dimensions. So he's only partly through his argument, examining largely the current state of things. We can still say it's the current state of things. When we left the last chapter of The Life Divine the last time we met, he had written this. It was so far that the race had reached when it found itself hurried forward by its own momentum into a subjective chaos, and a chaos of its life in which all received values were overthrown and all firm ground seemed to disappear from its social organization, its conduct, and its culture. And he was referring, of course, to the envelopment of the world in World War II. So we continue from that point. For this ideal, this conscious stress on the material and economic life was in fact a civilized reversion to the first state of man, his early barbaric state, and its preoccupation with life and matter, a spiritual retrogression with the resources of the mind of a developed humanity and a fully evolved science at its disposal. As an element in the total complexity of human life, this stress on a perfected economic and material existence has its place in the whole. As a sole or predominant stress, it is for humanity itself, for the evolution itself, full of danger. In other words, a retrogression back to an emphasis primarily on the material. The first danger is a resurgence of the old vital and material primitive barbarian in a civilized form. The means science has put at our disposal eliminates the peril of the subversion and destruction of an effete civilization by stronger primitive peoples, but it is the resurgence of the barbarian in ourselves, in civilized man, that is the peril, and this we see all around us. Effete, by the way, means exhausted. So this brutal side of humanity coming back forward with all the means of science at his disposal is a discouraging element. For that is bound to come if there is no high and strenuous mental and moral ideal controlling and uplifting the vital and physical man in us, and no spiritual ideal liberating him from himself into his inner being. Even if this relapse is escaped, there is another danger, for a cessation of the evolutionary urge, a crystallization into a stable, comfortable, mechanized social living without ideal or outlook is another possible outcome, and seemed indeed to be the largest argument for the efficiency of socialism in the middle part of the last century, when Sri Aurobindo was writing this. Remember, he's writing 1939, 1940, perhaps. Reason by itself cannot long maintain the race in its progress. It can do so only if it is a mediator between the life and body and something higher and greater within him. For it is the inner spiritual necessity, the push from what is there yet unrealized within him, that maintains in him, once he has attained to mind, the evolutionary stress, the spiritual nisus. So, evolution won't carry itself forward in humanity if we rest content with the acquisition of mental equipment. There is something in us that wants to push beyond that. And the mind is a useful medium as it plays between the life force and the physical basis on which we live. But the mind by itself cannot lead us to real light. That renounced, he must either relapse and begin all over again or disappear like other forms of life before him as an evolutionary failure through incapacity to maintain or to serve the evolutionary urge. At the best, he will remain arrested in some kind of mediary typal perfection like other animal kinds while nature pursues her way beyond him to a greater creation. Remember, Sri Aurobindo here is speaking about the movement of the evolution from matter to life to mind and then beyond. And each phase is more compressed in the time it takes to reach the next level. So he's expecting a supramental manifestation to move humanity more quickly towards self-transcendence. And by comparison, the animal forms and everything about us seems to be rather stationary in its evolutionary movement. Now, we know that evolution is constant, that it never stops. It is a law of nature, as it were. So evolution is always in process, even in those beings which look to have achieved a typal balance and not to be moving. Yet they are indeed moving. At present, mankind is undergoing an evolutionary crisis in which is concealed a choice of its destiny. For a stage has been reached in which the human mind has achieved in certain directions an enormous development, while in others it stands arrested and bewildered and can no longer find its way. Remember, Sri Aurobindo, trained in Latin, trained in Greek, is careful in the selection of a word. A crisis from the Greek means turning point, a decisive moment. And of course, in the field of medicine, it's that point in which the patient either starts getting better or getting worse, going to get well or going to expire. So it's a decisive moment. An evolutionary crisis calls everybody into wakefulness, calls the whole earth into attention. A structure, he writes, of the external life has been raised up by man's ever-active mind and life will, a structure of an unmanageable hugeness and complexity, for the service of his mental, vital, physical claims and urges, a complex political, social, administrative, economic, cultural machinery, an organized collective means for his intellectual, sensational, aesthetic, and material satisfaction. Man has created a system of civilization which has become too big for his limited mental capacity and understanding, and his still more limited spiritual and moral capacity to utilize and manage, a too dangerous servant of his blundering ego and its appetites. For no greater seeing mind, no intuitive soul of knowledge, has yet come to his surface of consciousness, which could make this basic fullness of life a condition for the free growth of something that exceeded it. This new fullness of the means of life might be, by its power for a release from the incessant, unsatisfied stress of his economic and physical needs, an opportunity for the full pursuit of other and greater aims surpassing the material existence, for the discovery of a higher truth and good and beauty, for the discovery of a greater and diviner spirit which would intervene and use life for a higher perfection of the being. But it is being used instead for the multiplication of new wants and an aggressive expansion of the collective ego. He could be writing at any time during the 20th and 21st century. So compelling a vision has he. At the same time, science has put at his disposal many potencies of the universal force and has made the life of humanity materially one. But what uses this universal force is a little human individual or communal ego with nothing universal in its light of knowledge or its movements, no inner sense or power which would create in this physical drawing together of the human world a true life unity, a mental unity, or a spiritual oneness. All that is there is a chaos of clashing mental ideas, urges of individual and collective physical want and need, vital claims and desires, impulses of an ignorant life push, hungers and calls for life satisfaction of individuals, classes, nations, a rich fungus of political and social and economic nostrums and notions, a hustling medley of slogans and panaceas for which men are ready to oppress and be oppressed, to kill and be killed, to impose them somehow or other by the immense and too formidable means placed at his disposal in the belief that this is his way to something ideal. The evolution of human mind and life must necessarily lead towards an increasing universality. But on a basis of ego and segmenting and dividing mind, this opening to the universal can only create a vast population of unaccorded ideas and impulses, a surge of enormous powers and desires, a chaotic mass of unassimilated and intermixed mental, vital, and physical material of a larger existence which, because it is not taken up by a creative, harmonizing light of the spirit, must welter in a universalized confusion and discord out of which it is impossible to build a greater harmonic life. Pollulation and an abundant sprouting or growth. Man has harmonized life in the past by organized ideation and limitation. He has created societies based on fixed ideas or fixed customs, a fixed cultural system, or an organic life system, each with its own order. The throwing of all these into the melting pot of a more and more intermingling life and a pouring in of ever new ideas and motives and facts and possibilities call for a new, a greater consciousness to meet and master the increasing potentialities of existence and harmonize them. Reason and science can only help by standardizing, by fixing everything into an artificially arranged and mechanized unity of material life. a greater whole being, whole knowledge, whole power is needed to weld all into a greater unity of whole life. Another term for whole is integral, from integer, one, the unit. Everything is part of one. And so he calls us back to a transcendence of this division that comes even from the highest manifest power in nature, the mind, to something greater by going inside, and he hints by going above. But we have to find that which makes us whole. And now he touches again upon his mantra of what is that wholeness described. A life of unity, mutuality, and harmony, born of a deeper and wider truth of our being, is the only truth of life that can successfully replace the imperfect mental constructions of the past, which were a combination of association and regulated conflict, an accommodation of egos and interests grouped or dovetailed into each other to form a society, a consolidation by common general life motives, a unification by need and the pressure of struggle with outside forces. It is such a change and such a reshaping of life for which humanity is blindly beginning to seek. Now more and more with the sense that its very existence depends upon finding the way. I think it's worth pausing for a minute and remembering that Sri Aurobindo's community formed as an ashram, because he couldn't find a better word than that, was meant to establish within humanity a viable alternative to the way that we typically lived, to live from inside out, to live from the soul upwards, to harmonize body and life and mind, and create a beautiful new life, one with another, in great mutuality, on the basis of oneness as an expression of unity. The ashram was intended as a social experiment to express that to humanity. So what he's writing about here is something near and dear to him. He gave his life to it from 1910 till he left his body in 1950. He had 10 years yet more to do and to give. So the ashram that he envisaged is not a traditional ashram by the definitions of the last couple of thousand years. It was one which affirmed life, did not call upon the rejection of life, but the remolding of life into terms of the felt oneness that comes from spiritual realization in our soul and in the larger spirit around. So, that is the ashram there in Pondicherry. But whoever picks up the works of Sri Aurobindo can create an ashram with that as its living center here and now. The evolution of mind, working upon life, has developed an organization of the activity of mind and use of matter which can no longer be supported by human capacity without an inner change. An accommodation of the egocentric human individuality, separate of even association, to a system of living which demands unity, perfect mutuality, harmony, is imperative. But because the burden which is being laid on mankind is too great for the present littleness of the human personality and its petty mind and small life instincts, because it cannot operate the needed change, because it is using this new apparatus and organization to serve the old infra-spiritual and infra-rational life self of humanity, the destiny of the race, the destiny of the race seems to be heading dangerously, as if impatiently and in spite of itself, under the drive of the vital ego seized by colossal forces which are on the same scale as the huge mechanical organization of life and scientific knowledge which it has evolved, a scale too large for its reason and will to handle, into a prolonged confusion and perilous crisis and darkness of violent shifting incertitude. Even if this turns out to be a passing phase or appearance, and a tolerable structural accommodation is found, which will enable mankind to proceed less catastrophically on its uncertain journey, this can only be a respite. For the problem is fundamental, and in putting it, evolutionary nature in man is confronting herself with a critical choice which must one day be solved in the true sense if the race is to arrive or even to survive. So this is unavoidable. He's writing in 1940. He could have written the same lines in 1950, again in 1960, again in the early 70s, and again across the decades, because the question isn't being answered cleanly and straightly by humanity. Will you outgrow your ego? Will you outgrow your need to satisfy your appetites? Will you outgrow this old formulation of yourself? Will you be more? Will you be the divinity that I have planted inside you? So asks nature and that which manifested nature. The evolutionary nisus, and nisus is a Latin word which means to strive, to make an effort, an exertion. The evolutionary nisus is pushing towards a development of the cosmic force in terrestrial life, which needs a larger mental and vital being to support it, a wider mind, a greater, wider, more conscious, unanimized life soul, anima. And that again needs an unveiling of the supporting soul and spiritual self within to maintain it. So, how do you develop a larger mental and vital being? Through yoga, through tapasya. How do you develop a wider mind, something that probes within and finds the meaning and the source of life, that reveals the nature of your self, personally, universally? Yoga. So essentially, he's laying it upon those who feel called through their aspiration to the practice of yoga to recognize that they are the laboratory, individually and collectively working in harmony. They are the laboratory in which this greater humanity can work itself out and articulate it first to the world. They have to be the first successful community in which unity, mutuality, and harmony exists. If we can't do it in the Aurobindonian communities around the world, if we can't connect here, do I need to complete the sentence? A rational and scientific formula of the vitalistic and materialistic human being and his life. A search for a perfected economic society and the democratic cultus of the average man or all that the modern mind presents us in this crisis as a light for its solution. Whatever the truth supporting these ideas, this is clearly not enough to meet the need of a humanity which is missioned to evolve beyond itself, or at any rate, if it is to live, must evolve far beyond anything that it at present is. A life instinct in the race and in the average man himself has felt the inadequacy and has been driving towards a reversal of values or a discovery of new values and a transfer of life to a new foundation. This has taken the form of an attempt to find a simple and ready-made basis of unity, mutuality, harmony for the common life. To enforce it by a suppression of the competitive clash of egos, and so to arrive at a life of identity for the community in place of a life of difference. But to realize these desirable ends, the means adopted have been the forcible and successful materialization of a few restricted ideas or slogans enthroned to the exclusion of all other thought. The suppression of the mind of the individual, a mechanized compression of the elements of life, a mechanized unity and drive of the life force, a coercion of man by the state, the substitution of the communal for the individual ego. The communal ego is idealized as the soul of the nation, the race, the community. But this is a colossal and may turn out to be a fatal error. A forced and imposed unanimity of mind, life, action, raised to their highest tension under the drive of something which is thought to be greater, the collective soul, the collective life, is the formula found. But this obscure collective being is not the soul or self of the community. It is a life force that rises from the subconscient, and if denied the light of guidance by the reason, can be driven only by dark, massive forces which are powerful but dangerous for the race because they are alien to the conscious evolution of which man is the trustee and bearer. It is not in this direction that evolutionary nature has pointed mankind. This is a reversion towards something that she had left behind her. And here this prematurely ended search for a nation's soul, of course, adverts to the attempts in Europe in World War II that found an inadequate basis for self-determination. Another solution that is attempted reposes still on the materialistic reason and a unified organization of the economic life of the race. But the method that is being employed is the same. A forced compression and imposed unanimity of mind and life, and a mechanical organization of the communal existence. A unanimity of this kind can only be maintained by a compression of all freedom of thought and life, and that must bring about either the efficient stability of a termite civilization, or a drying up of the springs of life and a swift or slow decadence. It is through the growth of consciousness that the collective soul and its life can become aware of itself and develop. The free play of mind and life is essential for the growth of consciousness, for mind and life are the soul's only instrumentation until a higher instrumentation develops. They must not be inhibited in their action or rendered rigid, unplastic, and unprogressive. The difficulties or disorders engendered by the growth of the individual mind and life cannot be healthfully removed by the suppression of the individual. The true cure can only be achieved by his progression to a greater consciousness in which he is fulfilled and perfected. So the machinery that modern science has brought and the rationale of its thinking to manage and govern with greater efficiency the social life of millions and millions of people as humanity has expanded is not the basis upon which we can have a soulful humanity. We can't reach the psychic center. We won't be permitted to do it even individually if those hedges are built around us, let alone we'll be able to manifest the soul of a group, of a community, of a city, of a state, of a country, of a world. So we can't suppress life, mind, or the soul. They must be given free scope, but scope to grow upwards. They must be ennobled, called to live higher and higher forms of life, not simply loll about in the gratification of senses. An alternative solution is the development of an enlightened reason and will of the normal man, consenting to a new socialized life in which he will subordinate his ego for the sake of the right arrangement of the life of the community. If we inquire how this radical change is to be brought about, two agencies seem to be suggested. The agency of a greater and better mental knowledge, right ideas, right information, right training of the social and civic individual, and the agency of a new social machinery, which will solve everything by the magic of the social machine cutting humanity into a better pattern. But it has not been found in experience, whatever might have once been hoped, that education and intellectual training by itself can change man. It only provides the human individual and collective ego with better information and a more efficient machinery for its self-affirmation, but leaves it the same unchanged human ego. Nor can human mind and life be cut into perfection, even into what is thought to be perfection, a constructed substitute, by any kind of social machinery. Matter can be so cut, thought can be so cut. But in our human existence, matter and thought are only instruments for the soul and the life force. Machinery cannot form the soul and life force into standardized shapes. It can at best coerce them, make soul and mind inert and stationary, and regulate the life's outward action. But if this is to be effectively done, coercion and compression of the mind and life are indispensable, and that again spells either unprogressive stability or decadence. The reasoning mind, with its logical practicality, has no other way of getting the better of nature's ambiguous and complex movements than a regulation and mechanization of mind and life. If that is done, the soul of humanity will either have to recover its freedom and growth by a revolt and a destruction of the machine into whose grip it has been cast, or escape by a withdrawal into itself and a rejection of life. Man's true way out is to discover his soul and its self-force and instrumentation, and replace by it both the mechanization of mind and the ignorance and disorder of life nature. But there would be little room and freedom for such a movement of self-discovery and self-effectuation in a closely regulated and mechanized social existence. So he's arguing against the state machine, or against the dominance of material values which would loom over the soul as it wants to grow. He's not going to write out here his larger social philosophy, and it was only adumbrated even when he wrote his great social works, The Ideal of Human Unity, etc. But what he finally called for there, what he suggested, was a simple but rich life, culturally rich, rich in terms of the growth of consciousness into forms of beauty. It isn't the possession of physical forms which makes you rich. It is the richness of your consciousness which appreciates the form before you. That is wealth. That is the inner wealth. And that leads to joy, to delight of being, and to a spiritually based commerce. Commerce is when we are all connected with each other, and mutuality is the source of the energy that moves and circulates. I think we're going to put our bookmarks there for this session. And I'm sure if you're looking at the pages, you're aware that we have two more sessions left in this final section of The Life Divine, the chapter of The Divine Life. This section tonight continues in Savitri what we began last time. We're in Book 4, The Book of Birth and Quest, and we're in Canto 4, The Quest. I'll read again the last lines of what we concluded with last time. All time made difference, they overcame. The world was fibered with their own heartstrings. Close drawn to the heart that beats in every breast, they reached the one self in all through boundless love. Attuned to silence and to the world rhyme, they loosened the knot of the imprisoning mind. Achieved was the wide, untroubled witness gaze. Unsealed was nature's great spiritual eye. To the height of heights rose now their daily climb. Truth leaned to them from her supernal realm. Above them blazed eternity's mystic suns. Nameless the austere ascetics without home, abandoning speech and motion and desire, aloof from creatures, sat absorbed alone, immaculate in tranquil heights of self, on concentration's luminous voiceless peaks, world-naked hermits with their matted hair, immobile as the passionless great hills around them, grouped like thoughts of some vast mood, awaiting the infinite's behest to end. The seers, attuned to the universal will, content in him who smiles behind earth's forms, abode ungrieved by the insistent days. About them, like green trees girdling a hill, young grave disciples fashioned by their touch, trained to the simple act and conscious word, greatened within and grew to meet their heights. Far wandering seekers on the eternal's path, brought to these quiet founts their spirit's thirst, and spent the treasure of a silent hour, bathed in the purity of the mild gaze that, uninsistent, ruled them from its peace, and by its influence found the ways of calm. The infants of the monarchy of the worlds, the heroic leaders of a coming time, king children nurtured in that spacious air, like lions gamboling in sky and sun, received half-consciously their godlike stamp. Formed in the type of the high thoughts they sang, they learned the wide magnificence of mood that makes us comrades of the cosmic urge, no longer chained to their small separate selves, plastic and firm beneath the eternal hand, met nature with a bold and friendly clasp, and served in her the power that shapes her works. Namaste, Jai Maa.